host, Dmitry Filipovich.
Welcome to the Hockey PDOcast. My name is Dmitry Filipovich, and joining me to recap Game 1 of the Stanley Cup Finals, my good buddy Thomas Trans. Tom, what's going on, man?
I love the Stanley Cup Final, man. You know,
do you think it's just because we went a week without hockey that it felt extra good watching that game? Because even when stuff wasn't happening in the first period, I was like, it just feels so good to be back watching.
I'll be honest. I actually think it was not in small part, like the presentation of the broadcast. We're down in the United States.
Yes.
We're watching on the ESPN feed. And I actually liked some of the reality show elements, bringing out the Stanley Cup, showing it to the players, you know, having them do starting lineups for both teams, like really giving an American audience or a casual viewing audience a sense of what these guys look like, who they are. I felt like there was almost, it felt like a show in a different way. And that's fun because sometimes the Stanley Cup final just feels like an extension of what the playoffs have been all along. And this actually felt distinct. And I felt like waiting the amount of time that we did, almost like an NFL news cycle week, you know, builds up the anticipation, the storylines. There's all this time to really sort of savor and build up the stakes and have the everything talked about. And every, you know, Tuesday, the story is what the Oilers are doing with their lineup. And by Thursday, I think all of that's fun. Like, I think all of that aids to the feeling of it being a show.
Yeah.
And again, I love the Stanley Cup. Like, I saw Greg Wyshynski bring up the fact that, you know, in the phase four secure zones in which the bubble hockey was played in the summer of 2022, the players actually played in front of the Stanley Cup, almost like looking at it as if it were, you know, the scenics from like a Mortal Kombat level or whatever, right? This is what you're playing for. And there's an element to which the final always makes me think about the cup and some of that, you know, the gloves off.
Yes.
Promotion that the league did, I think is just a useful reminder that as much as like Connor McDavid's the face of the league, like the biggest celebrity in hockey is the Stanley Cup, right? And that's what they're competing for. And if, having it back, yeah, having it there, and then for the game to be nervy early, some really funny chances, some really interesting chances, an early goal,
yep,
the environment itself, like it just felt like an event in a way that I think the league really needs it to.
Well, and I'm with you. I like all of that. I like the pomp and circumstance. I like making it feel like a big deal because it obviously is, right? This is the grandest stage and this is what we've been spending all year playing towards. I guess my issue is, why can't they just do this stuff like 25 minutes earlier? Because they start doing it like 5 minutes after they already slotted puck time. And I think everyone who's been following hockey at this point knows, especially once we get this deep into the playoffs, that the started time is more of a suggestion than an actual rule. Like, they're clearly going to start about 20 minutes in advance. But I just wish, like,
yeah,
they just started earlier.
Well, or just list the start time accurately. Like,
right.
What people don't realize is the start time for any game on the hour that's broadcast regionally is 7 minutes past the hour. So a 7 o'clock game is 7:07. A 7:30 is 7:37. And if it's longer, it's because of ceremonies, special events, ceremonial puck drops, or national broadcast, at which point even a standard nationally broadcast game starts 13 minutes past the hour. We're all adults. Like, you can list it at 7:07. It's
right.
Not a problem.
Yeah.
You know, I would just like some, maybe a little more accuracy. Like, they know when puck drop's going to be. There's a timing sheet in both locker rooms, and, you know, game presentation staff have it. Like, just list the time at puck drop. Every other league seems to be able to do it.
Well, you were making the point about how they wheeled out. I don't really remember them ever doing this before.
No.
The Stanley Cup before the opening puck drop to be like, this is what you're playing for. I wish they almost did it WWE style, where it was like a ladder match where they like hang some sort of like title belts above center,
right,
ice. And then you just got the players playing for it. And then eventually they'll be able to go up and remove them. No, this was a really fun game. I think you could tell early on, certainly part of it might just be because of the extended break, right?
Right.
Both teams had about a week off. The Panthers
getting
one night more.
The flow.
I think there was a part of that. I think you could tell that certainly with all of that pop and circumstance, I think, comes in acknowledgement from the players, right? Kind of like how uncharacteristic that media day on Friday is for, sure. for the grand scheme of things. And all these guys are such like creatures of habit that you get out of that routine a little bit. And I think you can see that early on. I think it's very explainable why we were seeing players kind of like misplay pucks or very uncharacteristically just not look as sharp as we're used to seeing from them.
The Sergei Bobrovsky adventures without the puck.
Well, although no, I think that's very on brand. Yes, he's been doing that all postseason.
One, and you bring up the media day practice. Like, even for the Panthers, they don't practice at the game rink.
Right.
So, like, even though they're the home team, it's like, hey, you know, day before the big game, let's put you well outside what you're comfortable doing, in the usual course of action, especially because the vast majority of players will live 25 minutes away from the rink, right? Even for the home team, it's so unusual. I think it added to the stakes and scenery of the game coming back, but I think you're right. I think there's no question it impacted the flow. Especially early on, and arguably for the Panthers for, you know, even longer than that, even though they were the first team to score, because I thought a lot of what Edmonton generated wasn't, and they had the better chances. We'll get into it at length. But I thought a lot of it felt as if it were the product of Panthers' mistakes, as opposed to, you know, and it changed over the course of the game. But especially in the first period, it felt like a lot of sloppy play from the Panthers fueled some of Edmonton's best looks, as opposed to it being stuff that they were generating themselves off the rush the way we've seen for most of this playoff run.
Yeah, it was interesting. I also wonder, you know, we see generally once series start like this, there's a bit of a feeling out period. And I think in particular, it's sort of indicative of who you've played most recently. And we spoke a lot about sort of the goalies that Florida's faced along the way here, right? Going through Vasilevsky and Swayman and Shesterkin. But on the other side of it, they didn't really face teams that posed much of a threat offensively, especially 5-on-5, right? Mm-hmm. I think the Rangers certainly, with some of their counterattacking and ability to sort of opportunistically score off the rush, presents a certain set of challenges. But this Oilers team is just such an entirely different animal, right? And I think it would make sense that there'd be an additional feeling out period in that way, and maybe like sort of recalibrating, I guess, for that speed, especially I think we could see early on, like when McDavid is just coming through the neutral zone and then off the quick regroups that we've kind of highlighted that Evan Bouchard facilitates, he catches Ekblad early on with one of those vintage rushes. And you could almost see like the, oh no, like he's coming full speed. And I just haven't seen anything like this. Not that it even exists in the rest of the NHL, but through their path through the East, they certainly haven't played a player like this.
Certainly
right?
Not in the last week.
The most dangerous, but the most dangerous weapons they've played are Kucherov, Pasternak, Panarin. Like, none of those guys are going to take the puck that way and just go 100 miles an hour downhill and beat you that way, right? And so I just think that was very interesting, and that's why I wonder the third period, whether that was instructive in terms of explaining why the Panthers' performance in the first couple periods was a bit off from like the sloppiness and the rust and also that recalibration, because I thought they looked like an entirely different team, and I'm not sure how much of that was you know, them being able to sort of just one-track mind, protect the lead, how much of it was, I think there was a bit of maybe Oilers fatigue because they were leaning on their top guys quite a bit, particularly for like very concentrated shifts, right? You and I were noting how it felt like McDavid was just taking these extended shifts where he'd be out for like multiple sequences in the offensive and defensive zone, and then occasionally was getting caught by the Panthers rush going the other way, trying to take advantage of him being gassed.
Don't you think it seemed like that was something where they're thinking to themselves, okay, McDavid's going to take these long shifts, and we think we have an opportunity going the other way. Obviously, that resulted in their first goal, getting out cleanly on the breakout. I also love how that goal, I think there's two things that are worth noting on it. The first is the puck goes deep, and Bobrovsky comes out to handle it. And having seen his giveaway to Zach Hyman, a minute into the game, I wonder if the Oilers forwards were like, okay, then we actually have to apply down ice pressure with some urgency.
Let's get three guys below the dots,
especially because this guy seems to be hot potatoing it. And look, it kept happening, right?
Like, it happened at the end of the second. Remember, Joe came around the boards. He didn't stop it. Dreisaitl came, brought out front, nearly scored as well, and that would have been a backbreaker for Florida. Like, it's been happening all postseason with him. I keep joking about how like on these one on one against the shooter, he just looks so good, and you sort of tweeted the meme like the big dog, and then all of a sudden when he has to go out and play a puck, it's like just an absolute disaster. It hasn't really bit them yet in terms of goals against, but it certainly is playing with fire.
Yeah, well, and so you know, I think they actually pushed down ice, in part motivated by having identified that. And, you know, it's a good reminder, like, as fast as McDavid is, as much as he moves at warp speed, against the elite of the elite in this league, if you have a couple steps on a guy late in a shift, even Connor McDavid's not closing that gap.
Yep.
You know, like, that play, I think, is worth keeping in mind. It's just like a back-in-the-napkin rule that even McDavid with the tank empty isn't necessarily catching Barkov.
Yeah, I thought Ray Ferraro did a good job of noting how in the third period, as you'd sort of expect, when the finish line is like within shouting distance, there was just less space and it felt like everything was much more contested. I was surprised through the first two periods how much space there was in the neutral zone for both teams off of these counterattacks, right? Like, I mean, the Oilers most notably got, what, two or three breakaways? I think three in total. The Panthers didn't get a breakaway, but they had a bunch of sort of like half ice down, two-on-ones or three-on-twos or even a four-on-two ones. And it was like, man, I've gotten used to watching some of these playoff games where like you're battling for every square inch and you're like, oh man, the next rush opportunity is going to be the first one we see in a period. And it felt like those first 40 were just like back and forth in that regard, where just like wide open, expansive spaces of ice. And maybe it's because both teams are so aggressive in that sense of like pushing in the offensive zone to create some of those turnovers, that if you get it past them, all of a sudden you're going to have a lot of real estate to play with.
Yeah, it's interesting. The way both teams want to play, and certainly the Oilers' forecheck had a lot of success tonight, maybe more than it's had in any other series this playoffs. You know, the Oilers attacking off the rush, and they really began to find space. Like, it's not even the breakaways, but I'm talking about like that Warren Fogel wrist shot attempt shortly after the power play expired. Like, sort of midway through the second, toward the end of the second, they started to generate off the rush almost at will, the way we're used to seeing them generate. But it felt like in the first 25 minutes, as they were building up this massive and somewhat deceptive, in my opinion, edge in shots on goal, it was really their forecheck. It was Panthers' sloppiness in some ways feeding the Oilers' attack. We're used to sloppiness in the offensive end feeding the Oilers' counterattack, or we're used to the Oilers, you know, just off quick ups from Bouchard, and, you know, Broberg had the nice pass to Henrique to spring that breakaway. Mm-hmm. So we saw some of it, but you know, it felt like the Oilers from the first half were really generating more off of turnovers, like almost playing more like Panthers hockey, which makes it ironic that the Panthers goal comes off of, you know, a clean breakout, sort of more in line with what we'd expect from Edmonton based on how they've performed to this point in the playoffs. The shots on goal thing, I just want to talk about this quick.
Yes.
Are you?
No,
I'm a good time for
I'm afraid that this is just going to take up the rest of the show, and we've got other stuff to get on. But I think that is sort of the story here, right? Because certainly it's on the screen the entire game. I think a lot of the commentary, both from the broadcast itself, but also online, that you saw was, wow, Bobrovsky's stealing this one for Florida. You know, they're getting dominated. And listen, like, Edmonton certainly got the better of the scoring chances, particularly on those last couple power play opportunities where, as we spoke about in our preview, it was funny, at the end of one of the periods, they started the power play. I think it was the end of the first, right? After the kind of like sloppy Verhaeghe penalty.
Yeah.
And they had 8 seconds left, and we're like, all right. And then the broadcast was like, yeah, they have time for one shot here. They're trying to cook something up. And we're like, I think they have time for like three or four. And sure enough, they had multiple opportunities. It's just so taxing, and you're almost like hanging on for dear life, like white knuckling it the entire time if you're the opposing PK. The Panthers held up in terms of not giving up any goals against. I still think, though, when you go back and watch that tape, the Oilers should feel very happy about the way they moved the puck on the power play and how they were getting Bobrovsky in these scrambly positions right off that rebound. Nugent Hopkins, I think, just misses the net, but it's about as clean of a look as you're getting out of a yawning cage.
As Sergei Bobrovsky goes
like full, he like cartwheeled,
on.
Yeah.
Oh, I was going to say Star Fox, like do a barrel roll.
Yes.
Full-on Star Fox mode. Also, that Zach Hyman chance from in tight that he skied just over the net.
Now, you noted on the power play, what was interesting was how much space they were affording Ryan Nugent Hopkins.
And then on the third power, I said it was the second one. So it was a bad pass, Bouchard to Ryan Nugent Hopkins.
Yep.
Oh, bad pass. It was a pass that hit Ryan Nugent Hopkins.
That he had to collect before doing something.
In his skates. Yeah. By no means. I don't think Bouchard can send a bad pass. Yes. I think it was just an under pressure, get the puck down. But it took Ryan Nugent Hopkins a minute to gather it. A split second to gather it. Enough time that if it had been McDavid or Dreisaitl, it would have triggered the penalty killer to attack and try and force the turnover. And the Panthers characteristically pretty aggressive
yes.
penalty kill afforded him space and time. And he was able to gather the puck, and the Oilers went about their business. And on that opportunity, they generated that Hyman look down low and sort of another one that didn't quite work, but was a pretty good quality look. And I sort of wondered, will Edmonton, given how smart all of those guys are, will they have noticed this and try to play through him a little more? And sure enough, on that third power play opportunity, if you go look at some of the buildup, like, they went to it.
Yep.
They went to it. So I don't know what Florida's seeing there. If it's
I think they're trying to sort of, like, tactically force him to be the initiator in terms of, like, we want you to actually shoot here. Not right. that he has a bad shot, but if you're kind of picking your poison, I think
sure.
where you can get in trouble is where he's more facilitating or playing off the puck off those rebounds and kind of just lurking in the shadows. I think almost like featuring him as the quarterback in that sense is kind of an interesting wrinkle. I'm sure like all those guys are so good in Ryan Nugent-Hopkins in particular, as we've noted, never makes mistakes. So I think if you go back and watch that tape and then the Panthers try to do that again the rest of this series, I'm sure the Oilers will have better
solutions
yeah. or kind of like, all right, if we get this look again, this is what we're going to do. We also did see them run that same side give and go Ugh. Between McDavid and Dreisaitl, which is,
so nasty.
For my money, the coolest play in hockey right yeah. now. Like, it's just their chemistry and their ability, regardless of whose stick is in the way, like, they're going to find a way to navigate around it. It's just, it's chef's kiss.
They also ran one on one of their post-penalty kill shifts at 5-on-5, and it was passed so early, it almost looked like a quarterback anticipating leverage. You know right. what I mean? Like, just, like, trusting your wide receiver to beat a linebacker or whatever. Like, I like the coverage, so I'll go for it. And it was, like, a pass so early and weighted so perfectly. And it ended up with Dreisaitl trying to get a cross-crease feed to Zach Hyman down low. Didn't quite work out. Maybe a shot resulted, but it was, like, pretty scrambly.
Mm-hmm.
But nonetheless, the drop pass or the down low give and go between those two at 5-on-5, and it was legitimately like passed into the spot that Dreisaitl would skate onto before there was any reasonable inclination that he was even moving in that direction. I loved it.
You know what? I think the natural next logical extension for the Oilers, if they get into a situation like we saw tonight where there's about 6 or 7 minutes left, you're down multiple goals, you need to create something you haven't, especially in that third period, they mm-hmm. went the first 15 minutes or so without like anything other than the one McDavid scoring chance. I want to see them almost double down on that. And just as much as I love Matthias Ekholm and what he does as a partner for Bouchard, just put Ryan Nugent-Hopkins out there with
right.
the other loaded up top 5-on-5 unit and just go 4 forwards, 1 defenseman in those spots. Because, I mean, not only are you going to just probably have the puck in the offensive zone most of the time because that's what those guys do, but also, as we've spoken about, like, Nugent-Hopkins is so good backtracking and being like the last man back and all that stuff that I don't actually think there's that much of a defensive liability. It's obviously yep. not as good defensively as Matthias Ekholm, but I think you can kind of fake it for a couple of those stretches. And I just love to see them sort of press down on that. But I don't know. It felt like maybe just because of that usage, that entire unit didn't really feel as dangerous down the stretch in that third period. Mm-hmm. And maybe it's just a testament to how well Florida defended that lead, right? I thought that was a pretty clinical defense by them in the third. Like, they had multiple shifts where they were just leaning on Edmonton in the offensive zone and
yeah.
kind of cycling the puck and just killing McDavid Dreisaitl shifts 40 seconds at a time doing
awesome.
So. And that was really
cool
to see.
That was their best 15 minutes. The last 15 minutes of the
game was
far and away Florida's best.
I mean, honestly,
only
that one sequence where Ekblad, I think, thought there was going to be an icing and McDavid just kind of skated
right.
around him. And then that led to a scoring chance about 10 seconds later.
Yeah,
that was
Dreisaitl
the only good look I thought
yeah.
Edmonton got in that entire third period. And so, you know, kudos to Florida because in that spot, like down two
That's
goals,
easy.
Edmonton's usually at least, you know, buzzing around and they weren't really doing that thing.
Well, and they had that whole minute with, you know, 4:30 left on the clock or whatever. And you almost wonder if McDavid's able to get loose and carry the puck and they get set up and they start to do their retrieval thing and get you spinning. I mean, does Knobloch go for a aggressive goalie pull there? Mm. Like, how different does the game look, right? You kill that shift. The next group, like the McLeod line, doesn't necessarily gain like full possession down low the way you'd feel comfortable. Goalie doesn't get out to like 2.5 minutes.
Yep.
I mean, that's a huge 2 minutes exhausted without generating a major look. You know, Panthers defense finally came to play late. And not that they're, again, so this is where I think the 11-4 or whatever it was shot total in the first period, I think it ended up being 14-4 once they double-checked it. Because you know how shot totals are in the gambling age, right? Yep. They're up and down. They're vacillating as the game goes along. And I think what people missed a little bit, or at least the commentary missed a little bit, was when McDavid is on the ice, team's entire bandwidth, everything they're doing, is designed to make sure there's multiple, ideally three, layers between him and the net at all times. And you know what's going to happen when that happens? You're going to get outshot. Like, you're going to get outshot because you're not focused on, if we win it here, we break out like this. Or, like, it's, you're selling out to prevent, you know, this atomic bomb hockey player from exploding on you. And that was the major driver, in the first period anyway, of some of the crooked shot totals we saw. Like, that and the power play. McDavid was on the ice for 9 of 14 Oilers shots after 20 minutes, right? Now, Edmonton had still outshot the Panthers in the other minutes, but not by a massive, you know, they're dominating. The deserve to win a meter says it's 96% Oilers.
Right.
Like, not to that extent. And in fact, for much of the first frame, I thought the non-McDavid minutes looked really ugly for Edmonton. Like, the Panthers kept them pinned far too frequently at their own blue line. I thought they did a creditable job against McDavid, especially early in the game. There were definitely scoring opportunities. They weren't flawless. They gave up the Henrique breakaway in that stretch of game. They gave up the McDavid rush chance in that stretch of game. But I thought they did a pretty good job of limiting Edmonton's looks. And then I thought they did a phenomenal job of just completely bottling up Edmonton's second and third pair on the breakout. Like, Edmonton just could not get moving. And this, once again, sort of brings us to, you know, the Canucks conversation that we'd been having in the lead up to the series, which is that when Edmonton doesn't ice their fastest possible lineup, you know, and with Derek Ryan out of the lineup, you're not doing it. Certainly, you know, with Corey Perry, who I didn't think had a bad game by any means, although didn't he finish as their low man in 5-on-5 ice time? Yeah. So I don't think Knobloch failed to recognize it. But, you know, it's not on him. Like, it's not about Corey Perry's individual performance.
It's about the idea.
It's about the style.
Yeah.
It's about the fact that with the personnel that Edmonton has on the ice with their second and third pairs, especially if they're self-matching Bouchard and McDavid with the discipline that they always are, right? Speed up front helps protect, you know, helps protect the Oilers' defenders in non-McDavid minutes. And man, it makes a huge difference. It just felt like for too much of the evening, they weren't finding consistent, simple solutions to exit their zone with speed. And I think that allowed Florida to dictate, at least early on, you know, up until the point where the game was 2-0, allowed Florida to dictate the pace of the entire contest, even as Edmonton was getting better scoring opportunities.
Yes. Yeah, we were noting how I think Florida would certainly prefer for as much sort of chaos in terms of back and forth and events happening. And that's a bit of unfamiliar territory, I think, for Edmonton, because, you know, maybe against Dallas, they wanted to, like, manage it a little bit better. You don't want to necessarily play the way you did in Game 6 against them, but certainly the first two rounds of this postseason, I think the Oilers were very firmly in the position of, we want to just be the aggressor and take it to this opposition because they want to kill time without anything happening, and we are going to take it to them. And this, I think they still want to do that against Florida, ideally, but I think they need to do it in a more careful manner because Florida's so good at turning these little miscues or breakdowns into scoring chances, and I think that's what we saw tonight. Let's take a break here, and then when we come back, we'll jump right back in. We'll keep chatting about what we saw in Game 1. You're listening to the Hockey PDOcast streaming on the Sportsnet Radio Network. All right, we're back here in the Hockey PDOcast with Thomas Drantz. We are chatting on this Saturday evening after Game 1 of the Stanley Cup Final. I love this because you and I have slightly different approaches, I guess, to when we do shows. Like, you're certainly watching as much of this stuff as I am, but you're kind of coming in and you're freewheeling it, right? You've got this ability to sort of work off of your memory and just, like, go and kind of go on tangents and go back and forth. For me, I much prefer to, like, go back and rewatch it, dig into the numbers, kind of wonder why some things look the way they did, write down all these notes, and then just
have... We've got an odd couple approach.
We do have an odd couple approach, but what I love about this is we are literally recording, like, just... Let's give them a peek behind the curtain. We finished the game, we crushed the pizza, because we needed a little sustenance, right? Yep. And then we just got into it right now. So I haven't had really had a chance to even look at the numbers necessarily. Certainly haven't had a chance to rewatch it. Maybe it'll make for a fun thing, because... I think after game two, we're going to do a similar thing, right? Mm-hmm. Where we record right after the show. We'll try to post it right away. And then maybe in the day off in between, we can do like a kind of like an eye test in terms of night of reaction, and then more a sober look the next day where like I rewatch it and have a chance to actually do my usual process. But just going off of it, I felt like...
So this is your buzzer column take.
Yes, it is. It is. Except I'm not really rushing to file it, you know? Like we can have some fun with this. For me... I thought Barkov was sensational tonight. And if you just look at the box score in terms of his on-ice metrics, right, I think around 12 minutes or so head-to-head, 5-on-5, McDavid got the better of him from a shots and chances perspective, right, even though the only goal scored was that one set up by Barkov.
This is exactly why.
But that's exactly what you were saying right before we went to break, where a lot of these sequences were him being glued to McDavid and the Oilers having territorial possession in that way and getting some shots, but it never really feeling like... I mean, there was a bit scrambly opportunities where you're like, oh, that was, you know, that bounce could have gone a different way, and that's kind of the dangerous game you play with when you give a team possession time like that. But for the most part, it was like, man, he was in his hip pocket. I thought he was disrupting a ton. Some of the stuff he was doing in vintage Barkov fashion around the defensive zone blue line, where like he would just challenge Dreisaitl on the PK once. I think Bouchard wants to just knock it away from them, clear the zone.
Clear the zone twice.
This is the stuff that he does better than anyone, and it was on full display in this game.
So that was the first Oilers power play opportunity in the first. Not the late one, because they only had 8 seconds of that in the first. And... Look, I don't want to use something like that set the tone, because I actually thought the Oilers' power play adjusted really well. But Dreisaitl was a lot lower in the zone after that.
Yeah.
I mean, honestly, the way that like the character on the Islanders' fish sticks jersey, right? Barkov's just out there harpooning pucks away from attacking players. Like that moment where he smacked the puck away from Dreisaitl to clear the zone in the first period on the penalty kill, that looked so Panarin versus Barkov from the Eastern Conference Final, like carbon copy.
Yep.
I swear, if we cut the two videos of Panarin in Game 6, you know, making 18 extra deeks just to like take a low percentage wrist shot through Barkov, that's how much it was in his head. It would look the same. Like it would look fundamentally the same, and I do think that matters. Like, I do think that matters a bit. You know, later when, you know, the play moved to the other side of the ice and the Oilers began to generate more, like, it was... And the Oilers moved so much, but it was really Ryan Nugent-Hopkins more playing up that high with less pressure on him.
Yep.
You know, I Dreisaitl was more... Spent more time in his shooting spot as opposed to when they go Dreisaitl, Bouchard, McDavid up high, and then, you know, McDavid loops around and they enter... Like, it felt a little more static. It still looked dangerous. It still generated a ton of opportunities. You know, in fact, the Oilers' power play probably deserved a couple tonight based on the looks that they were getting. So I don't want to oversell the job that Barkov did, but just those little ability. Like, who is going to make this Oilers' power play, this Goliath bleed? Barkov kind of at least inflicted a flesh wound in that first period.
Yeah, I mean, I think he's certainly in command of some of this stuff in a way that is just so cool to watch. Such a calming presence, right? Like, he's just able to control large swaths of ice. Yeah, and he's like, and a couple backtracks where he would knock a puck down and sort of stifle a promising rush for Edmonton. I thought regardless of whatever his shot share was for the night, I could take it or leave it, because I just thought just from watching it, he was phenomenal.
Yeah.
I will say, though, you know, and it's not infallible by any means. I think the Ryan Nugent-Hopkins breakaway that he got seemed to me, at least on initial glance, to be kind of like a bit of a lapse in attentiveness by him, which is very uncharacteristic, where like that probably was his guy and Nugent-Hopkins was able to skate into it and beat him quickly like that. It happens. I just thought like the totality of it was impressive. Now, what's interesting is I'll let you jump in here in a second, but we've spoken about how, especially in this series, but really this relates to pretty much any postseason matchup between two really good teams, it'll come down to whose best game is better, and then also whether you're quickly able to force your opponent to play uncharacteristically. And I don't know if we necessarily saw that tonight, but like the first Panthers power play, for example, it was interesting to me that like after a minute, I think there was a stoppage, and Paul Maurice was quick to get the second unit on. And I think that was an acknowledgement. I might just be over, like kind of like putting too much stock into this, but it certainly felt like it was an acknowledgement of, if the Oilers kill this off, we know that McDavid and Draisaitl and Hyman are going to be the first guys over the boards for a 5-on-5 shift. And sure enough, as soon as that happened, Barkov was right back out there. And it felt like that was sort of a preparation for that. And it was interesting in comparison to how the Oilers run this stuff, where they're going to give them the full 2 minutes. I think in pretty much every one of those power plays, they were out there until like maybe for a minute and 52 seconds or so of each 2 minute power play.
Yeah.
And so that was interesting. Not that it's necessarily like a deal breaker or a deciding factor here, but just in terms of like, you could see how aware Florida was, I think, in their preparation of what was in front of them and kind of how they were doing these little things to ensure that they could get those matchups, I think, as much as they could, that they'd be comfortable with at least.
So just looking it up quickly, because I think you're making an interesting observation, and I do think we need to contextualize it by noting that the Panthers do run their units
with
a more balanced approach, not just than the Oilers, but then a lot of NHL teams. Yep. So the impact might be a bit muted, but I still think you're on to something here. The gap between the Oilers' fifth and sixth highest ice time 5-on-4 guy is 4 minutes and 56 seconds, or 54 seconds.
Out of a possible 6 minutes.
Yeah, so effectively a five-minute gap.
Yep.
And the difference between like the same five and six is
identical.
2 seconds.
Yeah. Yep.
2 seconds between Barkov and Rodriguez. So also that tells you Barkov's the first guy off.
Yeah. That's what I thought was interesting too. And I've actually thought that it was a pretty promising, right? Like I think Reinhardt got that look, or Reinhardt set up for Hagee off that bumper play. And then all of a sudden on the faceoff, they're like, you know what? We're getting him off because he's going to have to jump back on in a minute here.
Yeah.
And so I thought that was kind of interesting. The game within the game a little bit,
I guess. Yeah. Well, and I thought there was a lot of it. And I think there are some thoughtful approaches that Paul Maurice and the Panthers showed us in terms of how to, I don't want to use a word like exploit, right? Because you're never exploiting McDavid. No. You are the exploited one. Like, don't get it
twisted.
You're
just trying to balance the seesaw as much in your favor as you can, acknowledging that no matter what you do, it'll never be fully on your side.
Right. Exactly. You're just trying to hit the, you know, put it this way. There is no like narrow ventilation hole on the Death Star when it comes to playing McDavid.
Okay.
However, he does take long shifts.
Yeah.
And it did look like the Panthers tried to counter aggressively whenever they were able to turn the puck over after he'd been on the ice for a long time at 5-on-5, right? Mm-hmm. He is coming back at you with 29 after the Oilers' spectacular penalty
kill off whatever, their 31st in a row or something like that.
Not just kill it off. Like, I thought they were
stifled.
They were brilliant.
Yes.
Tonight.
Yeah.
I mean, it's so weird because we grade every penalty kill that does the job against Edmonton's, you know, monstrous power play on a curve, and it's like, wow, the Panthers. But the Panthers had nothing 5-on-4.
Yes.
Like, it was. Anyway, the Oilers crushed it on the PK, and you know that right after that PK ends, they're coming at you with Draisaitl, and you know, taking an approach to try and mitigate that while still giving Barkov at least a minute to try and make a difference, or at least 45 seconds to try and make a difference on your power play opportunities. I mean, I think that serves Florida well. Like, I think they showed evidence of like real thought in how to just do the best to tilt the scales as much as possible.
And still you saw that at times, no matter what how the best laid plans or whatever the saying is, just gets thrown out the window because, I mean, a couple times Zach Hyman, if in case you're wondering, like, all right, like, is he just standing in front of the net and scoring goals? You could see a number of times kind of like around the faceoff dot where the Panthers felt like they're like, all right, we're out of trouble. We're going to try to clear it. And all of a sudden, Zach Hyman just like tied someone up or won a 50-50 battle and kept them in the zone. And that's why I say it's a bit of a slippery slope, because on the one hand, I felt like for the most part off of the in-zone sequences 5-on-5, when it was McDavid Barkov, I felt like the Panthers would take that and feel very comfortable with what they were giving up. But also, if you put yourself in that spot, I think you're kind of making yourself more vulnerable or susceptible to those plays coming back to bite you, not to mention a random bounce off a stick or someone's body winding up in the net, which obviously didn't happen during Bobrovsky's game one shutout, but I think is more likely to happen if you're living by that kind of like slippery slope type of approach defensively, right? So I think that's something to watch. I also will say, like, it didn't burn them, but there were at least four or five times in this one where Ekblad had a chance to just clear the zone and just was unable to do so. And one of my sort of X factors heading into the series was if the Oilers would be able to make him the one to go back and retrieve pucks, because usually Forsling's been doing a good job of covering for him this postseason by being the first guy to make that play. And in this one, I thought they did a good job of it, kind of exposing him in that way and creating some turnovers off of that. So I think that'll be something to watch. But yeah, I mean, that head-to-head between those two guys, there were a couple shifts in the third period in particular where they were just kind of like Barkov was leaning on him in the defensive zone. And I was like, this is what it's all about, right? The Stanley Cup final, offense versus defense, these two guys just trying to create any sort of separation between each other. And it's just a really sort of satisfying thing to see play out.
Yeah, and I'd add that the Oilers' all-around speed gave Ekblad, but other Panthers defensemen, trouble as well, right? Yep. Like, I thought some of what we saw off of the rush came against, for example, Ekman-Larsson and Kulikov.
Yes.
Right? 10 minutes together as a pair, 1-5 on the shot clock from a Panthers perspective. So the Oilers were able to find a lot of space behind, like, all three of the less fleet of foot Panthers blue liners, which, you know, I think is something to watch for as we go through the series. Now, that said, we are now, 35 minutes into talking about this?
Yeah.
And it's time to talk Nurse CeCe, I think.
I mean, heading into this, on Friday, right, we had a show and we're like, okay, this is what they're rolling out in practice. I wonder if it's a bit of a sort of red herring or kind of like just throwing it out there.
I hope
and then
it's
you're
going
to move from it. Yeah. And then they came out and sure enough, they started the game together. They were on the ice for two more goals against. I think both were very sort of fitting for this type of miscues they've had so far this postseason and in general playing together. And I think they kind of highlighted why it's such a troublesome pair, why they can't really work together. And there were a few plays. I mean, man, I had to stop and rewind to show you the CeCe sort of D-to-D pass that he threw at Bouchard, which was like a live grenade from about, I'd say, 7 or 8 feet between each other behind the net. And it just like went through Bouchard's skates because he was almost blown away by the fact that that actually happened.
He tried it, yeah.
And there were just a couple. Like, there was the, what was it, the high stick in the neutral zone that CeCe got called for.
But it was with, I don't remember if it was McDavid or
yes, but
or
it just
Ryan
killed, it
Hopkins,
killed what
but
could
was,
have been something promising.
Yeah, well, and if you just leave it, literally there's a forward skating into space onto the puck.
He's a cartoon character. He cannot help himself. Like, everyone, he can play 65 to 70% of the game where nothing notable happens. And I think for any defenseman, but in particular one like him, you're just going to take that and you're going to be like, yes, I just want him to fly under the radar and not do anything obvious. And then all of a sudden, the mistakes that pop up are just so cartoonish. Like, he just cannot help himself. And I think we saw that in this game. I mean, the way he played, and listen, amazing play by Bennett, right? Goes in aggressively.
Yes.
And then with one touch, essentially gets it back out into the slot. Does. And it's like, that is a next level play. But also, as a defenseman, you cannot allow him to essentially just walk into that and take the puck from you that cleanly. Like, you need to either get the puck or tie him up. And CeCe didn't either. And that's just that's unacceptable at this point of the season.
He got outcompeted.
Yes.
Yep. Like, until that moment, it's a one-shot game.
Yep.
And it's a one-shot game because you guys got beat clean off the rush. You know, like, that's problematic to me. And then it's compounded there. The Nurse CeCe pair, I mean, 12-14 is, or 12-4 is a number you're going to hear a lot here. Certainly they
didn't. The goals against this postseason, right? 12-4 is their they've been outscored, right?
Yeah. And so that's a number you're going to hear a lot, and you should. Like,
yes.
There's, you know, it's not even like this is one of those where people are like, yeah, I mean, they've gotten results, but
right.
It's like,
They're getting killed. Yeah. Ray Ferraro was so good because he called it a mess, which is like pretty aggressive for a broadcaster to call out in game, and that's why Ray's the best and deservedly so. I think this pair deserves to be referred to as a mess, but he's like, they've been a mess tonight, And I think the Oilers might need to make an adjustment. And I was like, yes, they do.
Well, and we knew they would.
Yeah.
We knew they would. Like, yeah. At this point, you know, there's like an old maxim in sports talk radio that's like, what you want to do is tell someone what you're going to say it, and then tell them what you've said.
Right.
Right? And, you know, with the nurse CeCe pair, it's like you see them at practice and it's like, okay, well, I know that how this is going to end. Then it ends the way we expect. And then everyone talks about how it ended the way we expect, and will the Oilers do the obvious? And then when they do the obvious, we're all going to say, Knobloch, great adjustment. That really paid off. But why have they started every series going back to this? It's at some point you don't get credit for adjusting to the thing we know kills you.
Yeah.
You know? The other part of it was Broberg on the right side.
Right. They're doing this in, like, I think they're putting Broberg on the offside in service of enabling them to keep that pair. And I mean, obviously the worst part of it is allowing that pair to play together, because we just saw, like, they were on the ice and directly responsible for both.
But then it
against.
Has like a but cascading.
Yeah, it's like a snowball effect of, oh, now we're also forcing this young defenseman who has played a couple games here in a row, but didn't play for an extended period of time and doesn't have much experience at this level, to play on his offside in the Stanley Cup final. And it's like, oh man, this is a, and I thought Broberg played really well. I thought in particular when he didn't, as you noted, like there were a few times where you could see the offside thing hamper him. When he got into space, there was one time he just like cleanly skated it out. There was another time where he set that stretch pass to, I believe, Janmark to set up Henrik for, it was like kind of like a bumper play in the center ice. I was like, this is exactly what I was hoping to see from him, because he actually has this skill set to facilitate some of these breakouts against this forecheck. But the issue is that you're also kind of forcing him, putting him into harm's way, where you're not really allowing him to succeed, because he's going to have these plays where he's on his offside trying to control a puck that's bouncing crazy behind his net against the most aggressive forecheck in the league. Like, what do you expect is going to happen? And so I really hope that for their sake, they revisit this in the day off between games.
Yeah.
And like, common sense and rational thinking prevails, because I really do not see an argument for why you would continue going down this road.
So I'd add to the thing I always look for with D who are playing on their offside to see if they can do it or not. And by the way, like, I've seen some of the most skilled defensemen in the world struggle to play their offside. Like, Quinn Hughes isn't particularly good at it naturally. I'm sure if he did it for 1,000 minutes,
if he got more reps of it,
he'd be amazing by the end of it. But the one thing, and Broberg did this a few times, where they like try to switch places with their partner because they're more comfortable exiting in an environment where you don't have to almost like make a pass from behind you. And Broberg had like spacing issues on occasion while keying the breakout, and he like still made it work. It didn't harm them at any point, but he'd be too close to Kulak while trying to exit the zone, in part because he wants to make the play where it's more comfortable for him. And then more sort of painfully for the Oilers, there was that sequence in the first period where the Oilers are actually pressing, and it's kind of a slowly rolling puck comes back to him, and he kind of has to play it on his backhand, and it's out of the zone, and then it's offside, and then that's a possession kill.
Yep.
So there were a few things that didn't work with the Oilers' blue line, and I think it's unfortunate, especially because as frustrated as I'm sure the Oilers will be with this result, I mean, Evan Bouchard was maybe the best skater on
the
ice
tonight.
He was
phenomenal. I mean, and exactly all the stuff we've sort of we've been highlighting, right? It was like knocking pucks down to the blue line to keep them in.
Yep.
Quick ups to McDavid to facilitate rush opportunities.
In complete command.
Just in complete command, and just leaning on you in the offensive zone in particular. I thought it was an unreal performance. A few times kind of dancing around and creating shots. I know that he got a bunch of shots blocked and stuff. That'll happen. But I think like just how odd he was and what he was creating, it really showed you, if you're still kind of like wondering, if you're the last person on earth right now that's like, I don't know, is Evan Bouchard actually as good as the numbers suggest? You watch that game, and I think you get a definitive answer that yes, he is that good.
He played with so much authority.
Yeah.
I like the way that he occasionally skates. Like, he's kind of pass first, despite the fact that he's such a goal threat.
Yeah.
But, you know, the way that he'll skate with authority on entries, on the regroup, he's got to be one of the best in the league.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he is sick, and it felt like he had that game on a string, and, you know, the Oilers just weren't rewarded for it. I guess one final topic, we got to talk Bobrovsky, right?
No. Yes, we will. But I thought you were going to say we got to talk Eetu Luostarinen, who you mentioned how Bouchard was the best player in the game in the aggregate. I think he was from start to finish. Third period,
yeah,
I thought Luostarinen was a masterclass, doing a lot of the stuff we said of like him, Lundell, Tarasenko would just go out there and just have a 50-second shift in the offensive zone that would just kill the Oilers.
Yep.
Created a couple opportunities, one from behind the net, one off the rush to Reinhardt when they kind of mixed and matched lines, and then got rewarded, sealing the game with the empty net goal. And I think wound up grading out as their most sort of impactful player, both in terms of 5-on-5 metrics, but also just overall contributions. And so I really thought he was phenomenal, and it felt rewarding because we sort of highlighted that line as needing to be a difference maker against Edmonton's bottom six. Yep. In this matchup. And I think that's exactly what we saw. Even though they didn't score at 5-on-5, I thought if you keep getting performances like that from them, you have to feel good because you know that the top six itself is going to get some looks themselves. And so, yeah, I just wanted to shout him out. Now we can do Bobrovsky, but I couldn't in good conscience do this show without shouting out who I thought was Florida's best skater.
Yeah, fair. I thought Skinner was good, despite what the numbers will tell you.
I did too. I mean, how many shots did Florida finish with? Like 17 or 18? Yeah. They definitely below 20, right? And yeah, for a large part of the game, they were like in the low teens.
How much do you think this was like PDO karma for the Oilers for the way they eliminated Dallas?
I just think, I've seen people make that reference. I mean, this game was nothing in terms of
wasn't.
In terms of how one-sided it was.
It wasn't a smash and grab, fundamentally. No. But Bobrovsky still saved.
He stopped three breakaways.
Yeah.
And he didn't give up a goal against. Like, it's about as good of a goalie performance as you're going to get.
And he did a barrel roll.
He did a barrel roll.
On a miss.
style points through the roof.
Yep.
Degree of difficulty in a couple of these saves. I will say, I mean, easier said than done, of course, particularly for fourth-line players at this point. But if you're going in alone against him and you're trying to beat him five-hole or roll the puck along the ice, you may as well just dump the puck into the zone and go off the ice and go for a change, because that you're going to get the same result. Like, I don't know. I don't know if it's not in their capability. Like, at least Ryan Nugent-Hopkins tried to do something.
He tried, yeah.
And you get in too tight and you just can't lift it. It happens. But a couple of the other ones, and the broadcast was like, I don't know if they're doing this on by design, if they like scouted something. I'm like, I don't know what they would have scouted to think that's the way to beat Bobrovsky, because I could tell you right now that's certainly not going to work.
That's like someone telling you, go low on prime Jonathan Quick. Like, yeah. What?
Yeah.
No.
No, you want to get him moving. <It's> like,
no, I think Ryan Nugent-Hopkins was trying to go backhand shelf.
Yeah.
It's just you get yourself into a position. It's a hard shot. So Bobrovsky was great. Bobrovsky was great, but the Oilers also missed on some of their best opportunities. Mm-hmm. I think we are so used to talking about the goals that don't happen from the perspective solely of the goaltender.
Yeah.
And I don't think we spend enough time talking about the shooting side of it.
Yeah.
The role that actual quality conversion, because that also comes and goes. Like, that's also, but they interact, right? Like, at the end of the day, one team's shooting percentage versus the goalie save percentage, their opposing goalie save percentage, like, there's an interaction there.
Yeah.
And Bobrovsky was phenomenal tonight, and I thought Oilers shooters were wasteful with their opportunities. Not a lot different from what happened with Skinner in Dallas, where Dallas just kept missing glorious opportunities. And then Skinner's going to have a low save percentage coming out of this game, and what's he going to do on either of those goals? I thought he actually stood really tall. I thought he had a really quiet, solid game.
Yeah,
he's so in control these days, Dimitri.
Yeah, he's just so in control these days. I actually did think, like, for the most part, he made a couple saves there to at least keep this manageable for Edmonton, and it could have easily been, I thought, a 3 or 4 goal game at some point. Listen, I struggle talking about games like this because I certainly don't want it to come across as being like, no, Sergei Bobrovsky wasn't good, because that's not the truth. Like, he was excellent.
Yeah.
And I think if he plays this well, Florida's going to have a, like, beyond obviously the shutout, like, he's going to give up goals. If he plays this well, like, Florida's going to have a very good chance of winning this series or winning the Stanley Cup. I had scoring chances at 5-on-5 in this game, 11-11.
Right.
Now, Edmonton got like 6 or 7 scoring chances to just 1 by Florida in terms of the power plays, respectively. And I think that's where, like, the difference lies in this. But I've already seen a few, you know,
they
expected goals models or kind of things like this. And it just, I don't know how you can watch that game and come away with that lasting impression. Certainly, if Edmonton gets these types of looks in game 2, they're not going to get shut out. I feel pretty confident in saying that. Like, they're going to break through and score some goals. But I just don't think it was nearly as one-sided or an equivalent to Game 6, what happened to Dallas, as this. Like, Edmonton should feel good about the way they played. And if they can repeat this in Game 2, they're going to have a chance to win that game and kind of, you know, get the split here heading back home. But also, like, Florida did a lot of stuff here that I think was by design and also gave them some trouble. And it wasn't just nearly this, all right, let's just hope Bobrovsky bails us out.
I think Knobloch's a really smart guy. I think if he comes out of this game thinking we just have to keep doing what we're doing and we're going to break through and dominate this series, I think that would be a mistake. And I don't think he will. Like, I don't think he'll come out of that thinking that what the Oilers wanted, they were able to get. I don't think he'll come out of it thinking he can just impose, they can just repeat that performance and their will have been imposed on the Panthers. And vice versa, I don't think Paul Maurice will come out of that game thinking, oh boy, we smashed and grabbed one. Like, we, you know, I think he'll come out of that game and think, you know, a lot of what we wanted to happen did, and we got to our game late. And that's something we can build off, because we do need it to look more like it did in the third period. But there were still elements throughout the night that we were pretty happy with.
No, there were. I think one thing they need to fix is we've spoken about how they've been much more diligent in terms of not taking down penalties and uncalled for stuff and being more disciplined. I thought both the Bennett, but certainly the Berhegi one, were just like, there's no need for that. Like, and that's why they're very lucky, I think, to get away without giving up any goals against, because they were dangerous opportunities for Edmonton ensuing after that. So there's certainly stuff to work on here. I think this is going to be a phenomenal series. Like, if this game was any taste of it, especially since we're like, oh, they're both kind of nervous and maybe rusty after a week off heading in, and this is what that version looks like. Yeah. I think we're in for a treat of a series. So I'm really looking forward to that. Hopefully people will come along for the ride with us here as well. Hopefully you enjoy this show, listening during the weekend. We'll be back on Monday night, you and I, here on the PDO guest feed after Game 2. We're going to try to get that posted right away so people can listen, and we're going to go from there. Tom, this is great. Thanks as always. We'll see you soon.
See you Monday, bud.
Yeah, see you Monday. Thank you to the listeners for listening to us, and we'll be back soon with plenty more of the Hockey PDO cast streaming on the Sportsnet Radio Network.